Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 158 of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the solo career of Paul McCartney. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi, and you may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast where me and my three co-hosts talk all things solo Beatles. I am joined by my partner in crime, my backwards traveler, Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on, my friend?
Good afternoon, Thomas, and thanks for having me back for another episode with one returning guest and one new one.
Yes, one new one. We'll get to him in one second, but our returning guest is an author, and he's got a new book coming out called George Harrison in the 70s, which I believe it's a March release date, right? And he's returning for the third time, I believe, and that is Owen Ling. Owen, what's going on, my friend?
My name's Ling, Owen yes. Ling.
Owen Ling.
that was my feeble attempt at Roger Moore. Easier to be Connery.
More Connery impressionists out there than there are Roger Moore, I take it.
I mean, Connery, I mean, Ireland and Scotland aren't that dissimilar. I mean, being Irish, probably Brosnan's the easiest. Bond. James Bond. Right.
Well, welcome to the show, my friend, or welcome back to the show, I should say. And we're going to get to your book in a second, but I'm really also excited to introduce our next guest. He's making his debut on Two Legs, and he is, I would say, what, co-author and researcher extraordinaire of the upcoming book called McCartney Legacy. This is volume one, I believe it is 69-73, and we're looking at a release date of October as of right now. We're going to learn more about that a little later on in the show. And this is Adrian Sinclair. Adrian, my friend, welcome to the show and great to have you here.
Great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, you've been kind enough to pepper us with info, you know, over the last few years about the upcoming book and giving us some information. And we're really looking forward to this book. And as McCartney fans and McCartney fans out there all over the world should really be looking forward to this book as well. And we'll get to that in a few minutes. But Andy, you know, we were live last week and we talked about, when this airs, we have been live last week, and we talked about the upcoming Paul's Live, and unfortunately no European dates at the moment, but hopefully he will reschedule those European dates that he canceled in
2020.
But you're definitely you pretty much committed on going to the Jersey show, right?
Yep, I'll be buying my tickets in 2 days time. Yep.
All right. Looking forward to it. And that'll be what, number 11 for you?
Show number 11, yeah. Yeah, looking forward to it. You know, and I'm not sure if Owen and Adrian are a little aware, but we had a little bit of a gentleman's bet on whether Macho was going to tour or not again. I won that bet, so I'll take payment in the form of that Run Double Run box or...
Oh, wow. Oh, the suitcase, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, good luck with that. Good luck with
that. Tom, respectively, did you really think Paul McCartney was never going to play again?
I had a little shimmering glimpse of hope that he was gonna be done, and you know, some of those vocal performances that you hear on YouTube, you know, should make him think that maybe he should hang it up. But you know, it is what it is. You know, I'm glad more people are gonna get a chance to see him live, and hopefully, you know, he spreads the love for the rest of the world too, because I mean, he just tours here nonstop. You know, I mean, if it wasn't for COVID, I'm sure he would have toured in, you know, again in 2021 and, you know, and probably, you know, 2020 with those European dates that got canceled. But you guys seen him, right? Adrian, have you seen him live?
Yeah. I remember seeing him on a couple of days after I got married.
Oh, okay.
He played the O2 Arena in London, and it was near Christmas. I think it was December the 22nd, rings a bell. Me and my wife had got married a couple of days before, and there was a horrendous snowstorm in this country, and traveling anywhere was a nightmare. But anyway, we got to the O2 Arena, and it was an incredible gig. We were fifth or sixth row back, I think.
Oh, wow.
And he played Wonderful Christmas Time, which is incredible live. And he played Mull of Kintyre with a full pipe band. which was just incredible. See, I think that was my highlight gig. That one,
right? Us stateside
us Yanks don't get that. We don't get that to the Yanks.
Not so many pipe bands, no.
Right? No, probably not. But it's unfortunate because it's a great song, and you know, a bunch of us here love it. You know, I really wish I had an opportunity to see him do Mullet Cantare here, but such is life. Owen, new book, George Harrison in the 70s. Let's talk about that for a few minutes. You know, why George Harrison?
Actually, it was this fine man, Adrian, who helped me to pinpoint the record. During a conversation I had with Adrian, I said that I wanted to write a book about a solo Beatle, and he suggested George. And I had listened to Dark Horse, Extra Texture, and I thought, yeah, there's a lot to be mined here. And, right. There's a narrative there. He comes out of the Beatles, ready to embrace new territory as a formidable guitar player. He ends the decade forming Handmade, who are responsible for resurrecting the British film industry. That's not hyperbole on my part. They did.
It's true.
Right.
They did revive the British film industry. They produced such marvelous works as Life of Brian with Nell and I, and my personal
Mona
favorite,
Lisa.
Mona Lisa, yeah. My personal favorite is The Long Good Friday, because it's about the IRA taking over London.
Oh, boy. You don't like Nuns on the Run? God, that's my favorite one. Love Nuns on the Run.
Well, Time Bandits will always be my favorite. So
that's true. And in the middle, we have, you know, the Dark Horse tour, which, you know, it kind of culminates in all his fears of touring, and his marriage is breaking down, and there's that a great emotional core to it. So to be blunt about it, that made for a good middle section, because there's a lot of emotion to expand from that point. And then he goes into Extra Texture, and his life lightens up. And by the time we get to the George Harrison album, he's embraced fatherhood, and he's carving a new image for himself that is a father, and that a lot of that comes into his songcraft.
Gotcha. So it's more of a biography than it is just a history of his music in the 70s, then, right?
Maybe. We're not talking anywhere close to tune in length. If it's a biography, it's a mini biography. The focus is mostly on the music. I don't really go into salacity. If you're looking for if you're looking for like a drug sex scandal book, this isn't going to be the book for you. But I hope I hope what I can offer is a new portrait on Dark Horse, or like a new examination, a new look at Extra Texture, or just some of the more overlooked albums in his canon.
Gotcha.
33 does get a neat little bit of a kicking. Just gonna forewarn that.
I know. Well, we're gonna get to that in a second. But you're not going the Jeffrey Giuliano route, then, right? You're going.
Why you gotta go there? Why you gotta go there?
you bravely posted your ranking of the George Harrison albums not too long ago, and I found it really interesting, because even though I won't give it too much of a way of it, but even though I do like Extra Texture, I don't love it, but I do enjoy it. I was really surprised where you put that album in your ranking. Let's talk about that for a minute, and talk about what it is about that album you love so much.
Okay, so this was for Far Out magazine. I write for Far Out magazine. That's my current job. So I was asked to rank the George Harrison albums. I put Cloud 9 in last place, which raised a couple of eyebrows.
It did.
Sorry, guys, but I mean the production is overblown. I mean it's rock is. As rock as commerce, rock as stadium rock, not rock as soul. I don't get the sense George was invested into that album. I do think that was like his Let's Dance, like his David Bowie. I want hits.
There's
merit to the album. I don't think George ever released an out and out bad album, but it's compared. But I don't get the same enjoyment value as I do from like a Dark Horse or Extra Texture, which I think is like his. I think that's his acme as a sound artist. Like, the guitars are stunningly produced. He's putting in a lot of keyboards and piano. There's a lot of detail put into the instrumentation, which I think suited George, because he was because he and Paul were like the musical backbone of the Beatles. I mean, John was the ideas person, Ringo was the drummer, but these two were the ones who made the Beatles sound as good as they did. So I think it's good that we have like a wonderful, wonderfully well arranged and beautifully well put together album like Extra Texture.
Mm. Gotcha. Have you always been a fan of George's work, or is it something you came into later on in life?
By later on, I mean, I'm 28, so I'm talking the last few years of my mid to late 20s. I think I've enjoyed. In my teen years, I think it was much more Paul's work that I would have gravitated to. But I do think All Things Must Pass is the best solo album by any Beatle. I mean, because it's got everything you need. Yep, right. Got all the great hooks. It's got the intellectual content. It's incredibly well designed, and it's just wonderfully ambitious.
Great.
Yeah.
Were you able to, find, like 74 tour? I mean, listen to some of those tracks. Did you get a sense of how his voice? So, I mean, did you talk about that tour much at all in here?
Yeah,
and the issues that he had with the vocals and all that.
Yeah, it's interesting. And your co-host Ken Mike. Said that the vocals have never really been a problem for him, that it was all part of the ambience. So there's that element to it. It's not so much that he's haggard, he just sounds very tired during some of the recordings. It just sounds a bit labored when he's on stage. He sounds like Phil Lynott did in some of the later Thin Lizzy's, where he's trying, but it's just not happening for him.
Didn't George say on that tour that he felt like he was being harassed by the music press as well, and the music press would follow him around and they'd say they were going to write nice things about him, and then when he looked back at their articles, they chopped all the nice bits out and basically highlighted his bad vocals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's that damning song on the Extra Texture album, This Guitar Can't Keep From Crying, where he personally calls out the Rolling Stone reviews.
Right.
That's right. It was Rolling Stone.
Right. Yeah.
Can't get over Rolling Stone.
Well, because you can't get a sense, with the album Dark Horse. I mean, some of it is, his vocals are fine, but some of it is obvious that he was having issues, especially on the song Dark Horse.
Yeah. What I say in the book is I think it might have been better if he had toured Europe rather than America. I think European audiences might have gravitated to this more experimental approach to music at that time. I think in America they were expecting like a greatest hits. When I interviewed Denny Seiwell, he said that often European audiences are a bit more liberal than American audiences. And I've heard that from the guys in when I interviewed Johnny Eccles from Love. He said the same thing. That European audiences tended to be a bit more invested in fusion and a bit more invested in hearing things they'd never heard before. But of course, we don't have the money in Europe that they do in stateside.
Yeah,
and that's famously what Paul did in '72, touring Europe with Wings, because he knew that in some respect, he could hide from the music critics in Europe. Whereas when he went to America in '76, there was nowhere to hide. He was playing in front of, some of the biggest crowds ever to have assembled in America in '76. So, yeah, you're probably right there. If George had toured Europe rather than America, he would have taken less of a hiding, maybe.
But he wasn't going to do that at that point in time because he was so ensconced in the Laurel Canyon bit of songwriters.
That's right.
In California, just his timing wasn't going to sync up for a European tour at that point in his life.
And it's also fascinating too that he brings out Ravi Shankar with him out on this tour, who in the late 60s seemed to be very favorable here in the States. I mean, he closed out Monterey Pop, and I mean, people, if you see that, you see one of his performances on there, and when he's done, I mean, the crowd's going crazy for that. And then here for the 74 tour, it seems that he's not welcomed at that point in time.
Passé, really.
Bit passé. But it was also the first time a Beatle had toured the States as a solo artist. So for a generation, or maybe not a generation, but for many audiences who had just narrowly missed out on the 60s, this was their chance to hear these big hits. And then they hear George, you know, changing the lyrics to something, and he's, you know, he's presenting in My Life as a spiritual elegy instead of it, you know, being the Beatle classic that it is. When he toured in Japan in the 90s, he was encouraged to stick to the arrangements. So when he played something, he played the solo as he did on the record, which I read in the Graham Thompson book that he had to be told, no, play it as it is on the record. Don't subvert it.
Right. Yeah. Right. When he created the Dark Horse label, I mean, besides Splinter, I mean, did he sign many acts to that label, or was it just a very small amount?
Henry McCulloch, ironically, he signed to the label.
Oh, Henry was. Okay.
Yeah. Henry had an album called Mind Your Own Business, which I think might be a little pointed.
That's funny.
Yeah. I have the name in the book, but the band that had Ooh Child, which has heard on the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack.
Oh yeah, Shylights, I think.
Shylights.
Yeah. He signed one or two of the singers onto his label from that.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, and he worked with them.
Cool. Closing out with the George Harrison album, 79. I mean, what do you get a sense that maybe he was maybe disappointed that he didn't get the success that maybe that album probably should have gotten? Because I mean, Blow Away was a great song, but it wasn't necessarily a big hit here. I don't think so.
In several interviews he gave, Ashley Cann produced this fantastic book of interviews. Many, even as early as 75, right, George is saying, "I'm not in it for the success. I'm in it I'm in it for the art. I just want to do as well as I can." Now, whether he meant that or not, I don't know. But that's what he was projecting. He needed to feel happy in his art rather than how well it sold.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Well, the book is coming out in March, I believe, I've seen it on Amazon. You can pre-order it there. I mean, is there any other places people can order the book?
Yeah, so for European audiences, I would recommend the Sonic Bond website. So, like James Bond, Sonic Bond. That's the best way. Publishing stuff is out of my hands, but yeah, it's projected for the end of March. I've done what I can for the book. It's out of my hands now.
Right. And you were able to get a publisher.
I know that feeling.
Right. Thank you. I mean, yeah, and you were able to get a publisher for this. I mean, whereas so many Beatle authors these days are publishing books themselves, was that something you would consider in the future?
Well, I mean, I'd written a book for Sonic Bond in 2020 called U2 on Track, which was about, so this was another series Sonic Bond was publishing called the Decade Series. So you choose a decade. And gotcha. George Purvis, I hope I'm saying his name right, did Pink Floyd in the 70s. Mm. And I think there's a book on Genesis in the 70s. Andy, you might be interested in that.
I have seen that, yes.
Yeah. I thought a Beatle might work well, but there's already a ton of books written about Paul, Man on the Run, in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah,
I feel like George could be catered. George, I don't know how many books there are on George, but I don't think there's so many that.
Right. Yeah. You know, I'm looking at what I have right now, and we're looking at what Behind That Locked Door, the Con book, which you talked about, mm-hmm. and then you've got the Krupa and Womack book that came out a few years ago already, and then mine. So yeah, I mean, George Harrison hasn't been nearly written about as much as McCartney, or even more so John, who's probably got 500,000 biographies on John. This is going to be a great welcome to people's books collection, and I'm looking reading this no pressure. Hopefully we can get you on Talk More Talk as well, you know, and talk about the book once it's come out and we had time to look at it. So, but today, for the show, Owen, you actually came up with this great idea to talk about the song Live and Let Die, which I'm sure has some myths to it, which is also why I'm really happy that we've got Adrian Sinclair here, to maybe help bust some of these myths. Yeah, exactly. And, and to also, promote the McCartney Legacy book that's coming out later this year. Owen, you're a Bond fan. You're a Bond guy, and I'm happy about that because I'm a big James Bond fan as well. I've got most of the stuff as well. And talk about Live and Let Die for a second, the song and the film. Where do you rank it in the film wise? Where do you rank it in the series?
So of course it was Roger Moore's debut. It's easy to forget now what a big deal that was. The popular consensus in the 60s and 70s was that there was one man who was Bond, Connery,
right.
Sean.
Right.
Connery. they had George Lazenby, who starred in the absolutely spectacular piece of work that is On Her Majesty's Secret Service, that is by far and away the best Bond films. Bond film that's number one, but it didn't do very well at the time. There were rumors that George Lazenby had been very difficult. It later transpired he quit, but it was rumored that he was fired because he was so difficult. Harry Saltzman, one of the Bond producers, said, "Now, there may be another Bond, but it will not be that guy from Australia." And there was so they had to get Connery back for one more film, Diamonds Are Forever, and Connery made this big thing, this pressing, I shall come back for one more, and then they're on their own. And he made it seem like no one could replace him. And so the next logical step was to hire Roger Moore, who was this famous TV actor. I mean, at one point, the highest paid TV actor in the world. So he was familiar. Wow. He was safe. He didn't even have to do a screen test because he had shows The Saints and The Persuaders, which had shown how well he could acquit himself into action. So this film was a huge success. It showed that the world was ready for another Bond, and he went on to make six more Bond movies. So that was a really, really big deal that someone other than Sean Connery could be Bond. And these days, I mean, now they're asking, how can anyone but Daniel Craig be Bond? Because Craig has smashed all the records. And,
right.
So that's a sense of deja vu. The film, I loved it when I was 12. It was like top five for me when I was 12. But more recent viewings, I find the racial problems a bit problematic. So that kind of brings it down for me. I'd put it in the middle. If I was ranking the Roger Moore films, the seven Roger Moore films, I think I would put it that his two best films for me are Spy Who Loved Me and For Your Eyes Only. It depends on the... I might put Live and Let Die third.
Okay, Man with the Golden Gun is another favorite of mine as well.
That's very good.
So, But, you mentioned Diamonds Are Forever, which, as you said, is Sean Connery's last. However, there was, talk, and I think I've read it before, that that Paul was asked to do the theme for that track. Is there any truth to that, Adrian, about him being asked to do the theme for Diamonds Are Forever?
Yeah, he was approached to do Diamonds Are Forever. And for whatever reason, we discuss a couple of reasons in the book. It just didn't work out. But then when you listen to that song sung by Shirley Bassey and the words written by Don Black and John Barry, I mean, it's hard to imagine that theme with words and lyrics by McCartney because it's just so iconic. It's just so incredible.
I was really surprised to see how high that song ranks in the whole Bond theme songs because I've seen it number one, I've seen it top five, I've seen it top 10. Everybody seems to rank that one very high, and it is a very good song. Shirley Bassey is a wonderful vocalist on that track.
And Shirley was apparently told to imagine. To try and find as sultry a vocal as she possibly could, and to imagine a diamond as
Well, when I was reading the lyrics before I came on today, and yeah, I mean, they are quite sexual, aren't they? You know, diamonds are forever. They're all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me. You know, it's that's just not something that Paul would write. His theme would have been spectacularly different to that.
Now he might write something like that now, but not then.
Yeah, I mean, for you, it's fairly raunchy.
Right.
Right.
Not
right.
1971 right. or two, that's for sure.
Yeah.
when did agent George Martin come aboard? Was it fairly early on that he was going to produce the soundtrack album for this?
Well, George's involvement came, his involvement came later. So Paul was asked to write the song, as you know, by the producers, Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman. And we're pretty certain that he wrote the theme just off the back of the European tour in 1972. Okay. And some of the paperwork we've seen relating to the theme tune note that he was paid $15,000 to write it. It's not a bad payday. And but also, quite importantly, in some of the paperwork, it stated that there would be two versions of the song recorded. There would be one song recorded by Paul and Wings, which would play over the iconic, you know, red, white and black title sequence. And then the second version would play during the film itself. It would be sung by a soul singer. And originally they had someone like Thelma Houston, or I think at one point the Fifth Dimension, which were like an American soul group. They were were touted as someone who might sing it. Strangely enough, they were both under the same manager at the time, a guy called Mark Gordon, because we spoke to Thelma Houston to see you know, how come she didn't end up working in the film, and she just said it never came off, but we think it has something to do with the fact that she's not an actress. And the girl that ended up singing it in the film, as you know, is Brenda Arnau, or BJ Arnau. She was an actress who'd done a lot of work, or you know, a little bit of work anyway, in London's West End and in Broadway. So she was an actress and a singer at the same time. So yeah, Paul wrote the theme, we think, well, we're pretty certain actually, just off the back of the European tour. And then he approached George to get involved and score it. Now there's one interesting debate we always have about this song.
Right.
And it's a topic of debate for Alan and I, and we always throw this one out to our friends, right? Which is, there's a lyric in the song, and Paul was criticized about this very lyric in one of the reviews that came out in the music press. It said that the review said that it was grammatically incorrect. So is the lyric, "But in this ever-changing world in which we live in," or is the lyric, "But in this ever-changing world in which we're living"? You tell me.
Right. Well, I think, go ahead, Owen.
I'm fairly certain it's the former, in which we live in.
Yeah. Okay. Live in. Yeah, yeah. Live in. Two words. That's how I
live in. Yeah. Live okay. In. Tom.
Yeah. I think the same. I think Paul says that it's the latter, though.
Yeah, that's it. Well, this is the thing, right? Because we read that review and we thought, okay, we're gonna have to find out what the lyric was in 72. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we got hold of the sheet music.
Oh, of course 72. You did. Perfect.
As you do on eBay.
And it
says in the sheet music, "But in this ever-changing world in which we live in."
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Fast forward to 2020.
Right.
And we have the lyric.
Yes. I was just going to point that out.
And in here, the lyric says, "But in this ever-changing world in which we're living."
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yes.
So, I mean, have we been all getting it wrong over the years, or did Paul read that review by the journalist and you know, do a little bit of tweaking there? I don't know. It's kind of very hard to say.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting point. let's go back a little bit, because there are conflicting, you know, stories as well. You know, you got a different story here. I don't know how credible people take the Philip Norman, and then you got the, you know, the lyrics book, you know, and here in the Philip Norman, he talks about how it was George Martin who asked Paul to do the, he talked to the producers and he wanted Paul to do the theme. You know, that's what's written. That's what's written here. I did not believe that 1 minute. And then in here in the lyrics book, you know, Paul talks about how he confided in the Applehead, Ron Cass, about, that's, you know, right, his dream of, you know, doing a Bond theme. It would be great to get commissioned. Yeah. To do that. Is that more correct to the story?
Yeah, I mean, we found while we've been researching our volume, the most important thing is to get as close to the time as possible. Now, at the time, the story that Paul told was that he was approached by Ron Cass, who worked at Apple. So he knew Ron Cass. And Tony Bramall as well, who worked at Apple, he was also involved. He was like a go-between. So that, you know, that's definitely the correct version of events is that Cass, I mean, Cass approached Paul to do Diamonds Are Forever. Right. And approached him again to do Live and Let Die. So that's... That's the truth.
Okay, Paul, go ahead, Owen.
Paul ever commissioned for another one? I mean, that since it was such a surefire hit, it landed them an Academy Award nomination. Surely they might have come back to him a second time.
Not that I'm aware of, no. But then Paul's the kind of guy who, you know, he tends to like to do things once and then he'll move on to the next thing. Yeah.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. In that case, he decided to write the theme tune for an ATV production instead.
Right. Zugang.
And we ended up with Zugang. So, right. I mean, which would you prefer, Owen? Another Bond theme or Zugang?
Yes.
You know? I know.
The theme for Octopussy or something.
Yeah. If you're only going to write one, you write the monster of all rockers. I mean, Live and Let Die is just in this stuff. I mean, it might not be the best Bond song. It's by far the best of the Bond rockers. I mean, we've had Jack White, we've had Chris Cornell, we've had Duran Duran. Live and Let Die is better than all of them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Agreed 110%. Andy, your thoughts on the song Live and Let Die? Is a standout track for you?
Yeah, always has been. I'm not the biggest Bond fan, I must say. I am not a James Bond fan whatsoever. I don't like any of the films. I'm just not into it. I've never been into that genre of films, so don't crucify me, Owen and Tom. I'm not into it. But I mean, as a song, I mean, I know some of the other Shirley Bassey, Goldfinger. I know that some of the themes are classic themes. But yeah, I mean, Live and Let Die easily. It doesn't even though it's a mega hit and always will be. It doesn't tire for me as some McCartney classics do. I don't get tired of this number really at all.
Adrian?
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, it's been part of Paul's live repertoire for I don't know how long now. 3 decades, maybe?
Yeah.
Right.
Can you imagine a Paul McCartney gig? 4 decades, yeah. Can you imagine a Paul McCartney gig without the fireworks going off and Live and Let Die? I mean, it's probably one of his most iconic songs.
Absolutely.
You know, he really... I think it was the perfect marriage, really, wasn't it, for Paul with George Martin, because it owes so much to the production of the track. And the production itself was no walk in the park. It was recorded at Air Studios in October 72.
Okay.
It was October the 19th. It was.
Okay.
And it was really nice that we got the that version that was a part of the Red Rose Speedway archive release as a download of just an early mix, you know, an early take of the song, which was really nice. That group only, I believe, no strings on that, I believe.
Yeah, the reason why we have that is because the band came in before the orchestra arrived that day to record what the recording engineers would call an insurance policy. So they just did a band only take. Just in case it all went south when the orchestra arrived and they had to overdub it.
So if they had to have a backup, right.
That's right. So what we heard there was basically what would have been the backbone of the song had they decided to then just do it as overdubs. Mm-hmm. But then when the orchestra did arrive, the idea was that they were going to record the song live with the orchestra, as they would have done in the days that before multi-track tape, you know, when they were recording stereo or mono. And they recorded it with a 38-piece orchestra. Most of them were members of the London Symphony. But when the orchestra arrived, there was a bit of an issue, which was that they couldn't get enough separation between the band and the orchestra. So what they ended up having to do is they ended up having to strip the orchestra into two parts, send half of them across into one studio, and the band and the rest of the orchestra, which I think was the strings, were in a different studio. And from a recording point of view, they then had to coordinate two multi-track tapes simultaneously between two studios. So what we're hearing there on the final recording is like the recording engineer's worst nightmare. but the final production that you hear is just so incredible. But when you know what went into it, when you read what was going on behind the scenes, it makes the recording all the more incredible. And you obviously get to read a lot more about that when you all get your hands on our first.
Yes. Do we know how big the orchestration? Oh, go ahead, Owen. Go ahead.
Sorry. I feel the same about Strawberry Fields Forever. I mean, we take the production for granted, but what a nightmare it must have been for George Martin. I think Martin could have deservedly taken a co-writing credit for that, because it's as much his piece as it is John Lennon's.
Accurate statement, Owen.
Do we know how big the orchestration was? How many, at all? I mean, was it?
It was a 38 piece.
38 piece.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Now,
Andy's doing his homework.
Yeah, another piece that's kind of conflicted here is was it all recorded at Air Studio? Because I see some contact that's saying that it was first started at Morgan and then finished at Air.
No, I mean, they might have done some rehearsals elsewhere, but the whole thing was recorded at Air Studios. Okay. They were coming towards the tail end of finishing Red Rose Speedway. So they were in Air to do that. And the whole thing wasn't done in one day. So they recorded the initial track in one day, and then they came back to do overdubs and mix it on the 20th, I think it was.
Gotcha.
Now, it probably was never intended, obviously, for the album, but imagine if it was intended for Red Rose Speedway, what that would have been like if it was packaged and centered around a huge hit like that. And how that would have changed the perception of that album as well, to have My Love and Live and Let Die on that record. That would have been incredible.
I mean, Red Rose Speedway, the double album thing, is a whole different debate. I mean, for me, that's kind of one of the greatest debates for any Wings fan. I mean, Henry McCulloch was so incensed when they cut a Red Rose Speedway down to one album, to a single LP. I think that was probably one of the reasons why he left the group, because if you listen to the double LP, you see a representation, or you hear a representation of Wings, in full flight. Every member of the group has a song on there, and Linda and Denny and Henry. And then you listen to it cut down to a single LP, and it sounds like a McCartney album. I mean, but it's true, you know, it sounds more like something Paul would put out on his own. I think that was part of Henry's issue. But that's a debate for another day anyway.
Absolutely.
No, I think the Red Rose Speedway album might be Wings' the finest, as in the double album might be the finest Wings album of the lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm going to go there. I mean, my favorite Wings album, in the traditional canon, shall we say, is Venus and Mars or London Town. But I think if we're kind of going like the Zack Snyder Justice League route, where we're including the unvarnished, then it's the double album of Red Rose Speedway. I think it's super.
Red Rose Speedway,
To Adrian's point, though, and I loved how you shared us with the contemporary reviews from Disc, the NME. In that email, even from the Disc review, even the wording of the Paul McCartney, ably assisted by Linda, Henry, Denny, and Danny. I mean, even just that word choice, you know, saying that it's Paul, it's not Wings, it's Paul, just assisted by these few people. Even the wording of these journalists at the time really said a lot to not really establish Wings as a bona fide unit, and just Paul with some side.
Yeah, that's another debate, isn't it, really? I mean, it's one that it's one that Denny Lane has spoken about a number of times, hasn't he? He's said in several interviews that Wings was never a group. It was just Paul McCartney and others, you know.
Yeah.
And then that was a problem in the music press all the way through the 70s.
Right.
I'm in 78, 79 at the moment.
Right.
And it's exactly the same then. It's Paul McCartney news. It's not Wings news.
But if the band lineup had ever been consistent, that kind of theory would have gone out the window.
That kind of theory, maybe.
If they didn't cycle members, you know, like, but because they did, that narrative stayed throughout the 1970s, as it should have, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it varies on who you talk to, too. I mean, we've had Juber on, and he insists that, you know, Wings was a band. You know, he just wasn't just, you know, Paul's baby, you know, in a way. But it's interesting for sure. Another thing that's kind of written differently wherever you read it is how Paul got his hands on the Live and Let Die book. He was either given or he got it, you know. So, I mean, how do you describe it yourself, Adrian, did he get it himself to read, or was he given a copy? Because, you know, you'll read, oh, he was given a copy, or he got a copy. You know, the same thing, but worded differently. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one. And I always thought that he was given a copy. But then I was very kindly sent a piece from the 1964 Music Press by somebody who was following us online. Mm-hmm. And in that piece, it says that Paul talks about Bond, and he says that the first Bond book he ever read was Live and Let Die, which is in 1964.
Right.
So it's possible that he knew the story already and he had a copy at home. But interestingly, on the book front, two of the lyrics in the song come directly from the book.
Okay.
Because I don't have my copy with me. It's in a box at the moment because I've got so many books. I've got nothing. I've got nowhere to put them.
And you're paid. You just said you're up to 1978, so you've already solved that. Yeah, you're already
right.
But the lyrics, "Live and Let Live," and "Live and Let Die," are straight from the book. That's the work of Ian Fleming. So those two lyrics gave Paul the backbone for the whole song. Yeah. So the reading of the book was clearly very important for him, not only to get a feel for what the music needed to be, but also to kind of pinch the odd idea here and there, which he did.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And there's some more interesting stories about the writing of that book, but the writing of the song, but again, you'll have to wait for the book.
Fleming was great with his wordplay. In the Live and Let Die book, it wasn't used in the film. It comes up in the Timothy Dalton film, License to Kill. When Felix Leiter is maimed, he's left with a note that reads, "He disagreed with something that ate him," because his leg has been eaten off.
Okay. I mean,
that's just brilliant writing.
Interesting. Another big debate on this is, you know, we were fortunate enough to have Alan Cozen on back when we were talking about the Liverpool Oratorio. And, you know, he gave us a little insight on the book and at that point in time. And he talks about how, you know, George Martin, you know, he goes to Jamaica, I believe it is, during the filming. He presents the acetate, has Salzman listen to it. And then there it's like, you know, the demo conversation, you know, how accurate is that demo conversation? And then also he talks about, okay, well, who's going to sing the song too? You know, which again, I think, Cozen talked about, well, it's not 100% accurate because maybe, because as we talked about, Paul was always contracted to sing this song. So he's thinking that it was George Martin who misunderstood what Salzman was saying at the time during that conversation.
All we think, or the best way of explaining it is to say that there's probably a slightly more logical explanation for what happened in Jamaica than the demo story. Paul was contracted to write the theme. And as I said earlier, there were always going to be two versions of the song. Right. One of them was going to be played by Wings over the title sequence with the red, white, and the black, and the gun down,
right.
Down the camera lens. And then the second version would feature in the Filet of Soul scene, and that was sung in the end by BJ Arnapp. Mm-hmm. So that was already there. That was already set in stone. There was going to be two versions. Right. George Martin goes to Jamaica and meets Harry Saltzman in Ocho Rios. And this happened at the end of November in 72. So this is about a month after the recording took place. Between those two points, everybody on the production has already heard the song.
Okay.
And according to Tony Bramall, who worked on the production, everybody heard the song and they were blown away. They thought it was the greatest Bond song that had ever been written. Mm-hmm. So, George arrives in Ocho Rios to have his lunch with Harry Saltzman and talk about doing the score for the film. And the first time he talked about this was in his memoir, which is called All You Need Is Ears, which was written in 1979. You've probably read that. And I'll read you the dialogue from the book, which is, and Owen would probably do a better job of the accents than me, so I won't try. So Saltzman says, like what you did, very nice record, like the score. Now tell me, who do you think we should get to sing it? George Martin replies, I don't follow. You've got Paul McCartney. And then Saltzman, you know, in that very blasé way, goes, yeah, that's good. But who are we going to get to sing it for the film? And Martin replies, I'm sorry, I still don't follow. And Saltzman says, you know, we've got to have a girl, haven't we? What do you think of Thelma Houston? So if you look at that as a very black and white piece of dialogue between two men, you can understand how George Martin, who had no involvement in the contract talks between Eon Productions and McCartney, has no idea what he's talking about. That there's going to be this other version of the song that they've got to record.
So then that is very true then, because I know that's been tossed around as myth or fact or myth or fact.
No, I mean, I don't think there's any debate at all that conversation happened. Between Saltzman and George Martin. But what we think is that George Martin actually misunderstood what Saltzman was saying. Saltzman was actually saying to him, you know, we've got to record this other version of the song. What do you think of Thelma Houston? That's where, you know, the thing starts to unravel. And in 1979, there's no mention of demo or anything like that. You know, it's just, you know, what do you think of the record? And then, you know, later as the story's told for the 100th time, it then becomes a demo. So like I say, we're not questioning whether or not that conversation happened. We're questioning the context of it and the fact that George Martin had no understanding of the contractual agreement between Eon Productions and McCartney. So I think that's where, you know, it starts to become more interesting, you know, for us as a reader.
For sure. It's quite clear in the Robert Sellers book about the making of Thunderball. It's a brilliant book. That the division between Harry Saltzman and Cubby Broccoli was that Harry Saltzman was a straight shooter, whereas Cubby Broccoli tried to go for the more Italian American thing of like, you mean, how can I help you? You do a favor for me, I do a favor for you. But reportedly, when I think it may have been Lewis Collins, but when someone auditioned for Bond and said, "Hey, you the Godfather," apparently that was get out.
Well, I'm glad you're tackling these kinds of things because, you know, Paul, George, all of them, they have these kind of stories that they'd like to tell over and over and over again. Paul with that famous story, well, we weren't going to go to America without a number one. Well, that's not necessarily true because you were signed to do the Ed Sullivan Show before the song went to number one, you know, as you know, Lewison has proven in the book before. But it's just odd, you know, George Martin likes to tell the story. Well, I brought these guys, I told them to play. Well, you really didn't, you know, they were signed already, you know. So, you know, these things need to be done, even though you know, they might not live, they might be a good story, you know, for them to tell, but it's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think call. Sorry, come on.
Sorry, I think Get Back, the TV series, helped dispel a lot of myths we have about the right. Beatles. It's not all, you know, right. bravado and braggadocio. It's four musicians right. drinking tea and eating toast.
Yeah, so true.
Yeah.
So the BJ, our new, I mean, that you do hear that song, you know, during the film. Is there any information on that? On that track that you could share? I mean, is it a different production? They don't use the same track, right? Backing track. It's a whole completely different version of the song.
Yeah, it was recorded by George Martin produced it, and in fact, in the original paperwork about Live and Let Die, they suggested that Paul might produce the second version. So, but in the end, it was George. Right. We think that was recorded. It was either late December or early January in 73, where George Martin recorded that. But that recording, also to confuse all the music journalists out there, was put out as a single on the very same day as Wings released Live and Let Die as a single. I sent you guys the
reviews
from the music.
And
on one of the papers, is it Disc?
Right.
It calls Wings recording a cover version.
Yeah. Yeah, the group take it at a slower pace than Miss Arnaud, which seems to suit the song better.
Yeah. Paul McCartney is covering his own song.
Right.
that's an old publisher's trick, I think, is right. to put out the cover on the same day as the original. Yeah. You know, because they...
Yeah, thanks.
The publishers would sometimes put out a cover on the same day as the actual single. I think probably to confuse the public into buying both. So they then make more money.
Right.
That's like something from the Ruttles where, you know, Eric Idle says, and to make things easier, they released the cover on the same day.
the track, I mean, when you do a song for a soundtrack, is it always, I mean, the studio or whatnot, they get to keep it for a certain while. Paul gets to use it for whatever he wants to do. I mean, you know, because it's just weird how it was able to be premiered on the James Paul McCartney TV show rather than, you know, making its premiere as a single or on the actual soundtrack. You know, I mean, I'm sure Paul has it to where he owns everything he does, you know, whether or not it's for a soundtrack or not, right?
Yeah, well, I think Paul retained the copyright, didn't he? I mean, right, if you look at the copyright for that song, it's McCartney Music, ATV Music, and United Artists Music. So ATV, all three share it.
Right.
Because Paul was under contract with ATV at the time, ATV, so they would have shared copyright.
Right. Yeah. Up until 73, I believe it was. Go ahead.
He signed again with ATV till later.
Okay, he did. Okay.
After doing a deal with ATV, I think the reason why they did it on the James Paul McCartney special, well, there's probably two reasons. Firstly, it was a great promotion for the film for anybody who watched it,
right.
because they introduced it with the popcorn, don't they? Saying this is coming from
the
cinema,
and with some clips from the film as well.
The boat crashing boat. Off the water. That's right.
And in fact, that scene, we found out, this is how sad we are, I'm sorry, but we found out that the speedboat scene was recorded on the same day as the song. So they were cruising down the Mississippi Bay on those speedboats while Paul and the band were striking up at eight, although the time zones are probably slightly out, I probably got that wrong. Anyway, let me get back to the James Paul McCartney point. Yeah. And also, I think that they wanted a big production number for the James Paul McCartney special. And that gave them it, you know, when they blew at the piano and nearly killed half of the orchestra.
Who put the dynamite in the piano, Adrian? I've always wanted to know that.
I'd love to know.
Right.
Yeah. Whoever put it there, put a little too much there, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Yeah,
but almost it's very, very kind of reminiscent of the Pete Townsend Smothers Brothers thing with the Keith.
Definitely could have gone horribly wrong. Absolutely.
I think there's another thing with the James Moore Paul McCartney, because Lou Grade, I think, he worked with Roger Moore. And I think, isn't that his show? It was either him or his brother. But Lou Grade hired, he was the one who produced The Persuaders, which was probably the show that made Roger Moore's name in America. He made that show with Tony Curtis, which was this huge, resplendent, beautifully filmed show that John Barry worked on, and John Barry being the James Bond film composer. So there might have been a link that way.
I mean, I can't imagine it was a hard sell. You know, they say to ATV, so you're going to put out this TV special in America and in Great Britain, and you want to show a few clips from our film and play the title track from it. I can't imagine it was a hard sell. I think they would have happily agreed to that.
For sure.
Do you get much into? I would imagine you get into the whole lawsuit, you know, with Grade and the McCartneys, you know, the whole writing dispute.
Another Day. I mean, the book, you know, kind of is very much like Tune In in terms of the structure. So it would tell the story almost chronologically, other than the first couple of chapters, which have got a couple of flashbacks in. And then we chart Paul's time in the studio, on the road, rehearsing, you know, everything he was doing over that period of 4 years, from the, you know, the decline of the Beatles through to him on top of his throne again, when Band on the Run was climbing towards the top of the charts.
So the song is then now released on June 1st and goes straight to, you know, pretty much stalls at number 2, which isn't a bad thing, really. Number 9 in the UK, and it's weird because in the 70s he was, I don't know if it's weird or not, but I mean, having so much more success here in the States than in the UK. But then when the 80s come, it kind of like reverses, where he's having more success in the UK than here in the States. But how was it received in the UK, Adrian? I mean, you sent us a couple, clips on reviews on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, received favorably there in the UK?
Well, I think it's a strange one, isn't it, when you put out the title track for a film as a single, because, you know, music fans, I don't know what they would make of that, really. I mean, McCartney fans and Beatles fans would have gone out and bought it. But casual music fans who, say, bought the Mull of Kintyre and lifted that to number one for however many hundreds of weeks and millions of copies would not have gone out and bought copies of Live and Let Die. You know, I think British audiences, I don't know, they've got very refined or peculiar tastes, you know, they'll go for one thing or another. But it was released just off the back of My Love, which in America was like a massive hit.
Right.
And when My Love was number one in America, Red Rose Speedway was number one in America as well. And I think, wasn't Paul the first Beatle to have a number one single and album at the same time?
Same time. So, George then followed with Living in the Material World and then Give Me Love.
So I think it was probably a no-brainer in America that Live and Let Die would do well off the back of My Love. But in the 70s, Paul's singles never sold that brilliantly in Britain. American audience. And why do you think he tours America so much more than Europe now?
He did better in the 80s in the UK versus the US. So it like flip-flopped a little bit, you know?
Yeah, so I suppose that... maybe that reflects the music that he was making in the 80s, you know, that maybe he, to a certain extent in the 80s, he accepted his age more and who he was as a composer, rather than chasing trends like he did at times in the 70s.
Right. The whole glam rock scene, though, was huge there in the early 70s with T-Rex and Bowie and other bands like that, you know, having major success. So I can kind of see how that would, you know, kind of damper McCartney's chart success there.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, McCartney said, I think, in the late 70s that he spent all of the early 70s thinking that he needed to do or needed to follow the latest trend. So if other people were wearing lipstick and glitter, he felt like that's what he had to do, or platforms, you know.
Yeah.
And but I think towards the end of the 70s, he accepted maybe more of who he was. You know, he was a father of four and a maturing musician. And, you know, maybe punk had a little bit of something to do with it as well.
Oh, yeah. Right. Very, very true. Very true. I do have a couple copies here from other parts of the world here from the U.S. I mean, from for the single wise. This is right here. This is the French.
Vive la province.
Yes, right there. And then I've also happened to have a from Mexico. Live and Let Die right there as well. I'm just can't seem to find the picture sleeve with the Bond you know cover picture sleeve on it, so it's just so hard to find, you know. But I love the picture sleeves from around the world.
The B-side's interesting as well, because wasn't that Denny Lane's first vocal on I Lie Around?
Yes, I Lie Around. Yeah, he had the first two verses, and then Paul did the third verse. Yeah, so absolutely. Yeah.
As the NME, the NME called it a cute seasonal offering with the sounds of picnicking families and dads diving into rivers shouting. It's lovely. It's lovely. It's all right.
Yeah. It's such a hesitant vocal from Denny. I wonder why Paul didn't sing it himself.
Right. Well, he wrote it, didn't he? It was his right. Mm-hmm. It was
Paul McCartney solo. Yeah.
I don't think he'd recorded a vocal for that. Even during the Ram sessions, the vocal was added during the Red Rose sessions. And, right. Yeah, maybe he just felt that Denny's vocal was better for it. It's got quite a lethargic kind of feel about it, hasn't it? And works with that kind of slightly lethargic vocal that Denny has.
Right. We should mention that this the track did get nominated for 2 Grammys, Best Original Score Written for a Motion Picture, and Best Contemporary Vocal Performance by a Duo, Group, or Chorus. Unfortunately, neither won. And then it also got the big Oscar nomination for song for a motion picture, which ended up losing out to Babs. But, oh well.
Yeah, the first Bond song to win Best Theme Tune was, of course, Adele's Skyfall, which
So that was
which is a stunning effort.
Decades later,
and great movie, by the way. Yeah, there was a lot of fanfare. It was the 50th anniversary of Bond. Daniel Craig had filmed a cameo with the Queen at Buckingham Palace, a promo video during the London Olympics. So there was this big palaver around Bond around that time. And, of course, Skyfall made billions of dollars. It was by far and away the biggest Bond film in terms of box office.
Mm. Yeah. I had the pleasure of, I'm a chef, but I used to do a bunch of concerts or whatever. So I had the privilege of one day working a Weird Al Yankovic show, and I got to spend a couple minutes alone with him. And we talked about the chicken pot pie track that almost happened. And he talked about how, you know, Paul had, you know, was kind of teasing with him about, you know, when are you going to parody one of his songs? And then, you know, he came up with the chicken pot pie and said that wouldn't do because he didn't want it you know, animals involved in with the song, so, or promote, you know, food with animals. So unfortunately we never got to hear it, but kind of a funny story from where, from we love to hear something like you know, chicken pot pie from Weird Al. I think that would probably be
he interviewed Paul in the 90s. I mean, a very weird interview with Paul eating a raw steak.
I think, you know what, but I think I remember what you took, because I think that was on MTV, and what it was just like he took over the show. It was like his show, and it was just like, you know, him asking questions to Paul, but it wasn't like an actual interview. It was like someone else's interview, and then they would, you know, he would just ask like a silly question, and then Paul would, you know, he would get the answer and then edit it in there, you know. So I think I remember that.
But there is actually a clip of like, I mean, Paul demanding steak and like ripping like raw steak together, and it ends with Weird Al saying, "Now, Paul, I've always wanted to say, you were always my favorite member of Wings." Right. And Paul goes,
good stuff. Good stuff. The Guns N' Roses version. Any of you guys have any love for that cover? No.
No.
Yeah, no. It's you know, I did get to see them do it live. I did see Guns N' Roses back in 91, I want to say it was.
Mainly because the people that I know that like that song think it's a song by Guns N' Roses. That's why I don't like it.
Right, yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. You know, it's so far
including Paul's children.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah, Paul's children came back saying, "Oh, Guns N' Roses did this great song called..." I wrote that.
Right.
You know, say what you will about Axl's vocals on any song really that he sings, but I do really like the band, their performance on there. I like Slash's, you know, guitar work on there. But other than that, the vocals, I'm not the biggest fan of Axl's vocals on that track. But does George Martin deserve a co-write on this song?
No.
I mean, he did write the orchestration to this, right?
Yeah. I suppose the melody's all Paul, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the switch to the Jamaican, the reggae, you know.
Yeah.
That was all Paul and Linda. That was very much kind of their thing around that time. They were taking constant trips to Jamaica around that time. I know what you're saying, because without George Martin's production, that song wouldn't have half of the balls
it has. Applying that logic, you'd have to give him co-writes to nearly all the Beatles songs.
All the Beatles stuff, right. Yeah,
I would say no on that. Because he plays the harpsichord on In My Life, and he's not given a co-writer, you know.
One thing I will counter with is I think Linda McCartney earned her co-writing credit for the reggae section, because that's her idea. I know a lot of her co-writing credits are quite spurious, but I think that is one where it's well earned.
Legit.
Yeah.
She came up with a couple of the lyrics for that song as well. Mm-hmm. Again, more in the book. Sorry.
Right. It's all right. We don't want to give it all away here.
No.
Linda reminds me of Gillian Gilbert from New Order. People seem to think that all she did was look pretty at a keyboard, when she actually contributed quite a lot. I mean, I even when I interviewed Peter Hook from New Order, he seemed to suggest that all Gillian did was, you know, was do what Bernard told her, which it seems credit when you consider that actually she came up with the hook from Blue Monday.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, getting back to the whole ATV, you know, legal action, you know, about Linda co-writing. You know, Paul had a really valid point when that legal action came about, which was that quite often when he wrote with John, they wouldn't kind of half write a song and go, "Okay, John, over to you. You can finish it off."
No,
he'd contribute half a lyric, or tell him that he needed a middle eight, or you know, whatever it might be. And I think Linda had the same input with Paul. She was there, you know, to contribute ideas and also give the guy confidence. I mean, in the early 70s, his confidence was so low, and she was the one that said, "Come on, Paul, you know, You know, you're an incredible songwriter. Out there and do what the world, you know.
She has said that in a few interviews as well.
And I think she deserves a huge amount of credit for her her role in Wings, and also the amount of crap that she took, you know, as a member.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we've talked about that before.
To have the resilience to stand up to all of that and put up with it for so long. You know, what an incredible woman she was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody we've spoken to while we've been making this book says the same thing about Linda, that she was just incredible woman and, you know, great, an incredible person to be around.
Right. Yeah. I mean, say what you want about her keyboard playing. I mean, they are pedestrian. Her singing was superb. I mean, even on Live and Let Die, like her backing vocal, those ghostly angelic falsettos are stunning.
Right.
On the Ram album, you know, her vocals on Ram are incredible.
You know you did with her and you know, Denny are great. All the stuff on Ram that she does, you know, especially I like what she does with Long Hair Lady. Is really fun as well too. We should mention Ray Cooper on the track as well, the percussionist. Added some stuff to the track, or you know, percussions to track, I should say. Which was nice. Favorite bits of the song, Andy.
I was just going to say very quickly on the Ray Cooper. Didn't Ray Cooper have a connection to Handmaid? Didn't he go on to run Handmaid?
Yes, he did.
Didn't he? Yeah. Local Watford lad, percussionist. Right.
He was very good pals with George. George seems to be best friends with everyone. Name any celebrity from the time. George was best pals with him. Elton John, Eric Idle, Roy Cooper.
Right. The bits of the song, Andy, do you have any standout parts of the song that you enjoy the most, or are you just a fan of the whole?
Well, no, obviously I think my favorite part of the song is the George Martin orchestration. That's the Hollywood, you know, build up, you know, that best part of it. The whole song is great, but that part of it is just trim. And then just the whole break into the middle eight of the Jamaican stuff makes it such a unique, you know, great, because you don't, it's so left field. All of a sudden, boom, what does it matter to you? You're like, whoa, what's that? So everything about it, but the orchestration is probably my favorite part.
There's a great little, if you got headphones on, this is the best way to listen to it. I think there's a, right before he does the second, used to say Live and Let Live, there's this great little violin solo that goes on for a couple seconds. That's really pretty. And just a great addition to the track. Owen?
I'm going to go with the intro, just, you know, with the piano and the way his vocal comes in. I mean, it reminds me of the gun barrel setup before every Bond film. It's just that little teaser of excitement before, you know, before the film starts. It's just that little, this little plink.
Good point.
Plink.
Yes.
Plink. Yeah. Right. It's just that always gets a little chuckle from me and a little smile.
Cool. Adrian?
I was listening to it before we came on here, and actually my favorite part is something really small in the orchestration by George Martin, which is when you get that orchestration starts, there's these really discordant violins that come in that sound kind of like in a minor key, and they sound so unnerving, and I don't know, there's just something about that George Martin score. It's so complex. There's so much going on there. Every time you listen to the song, you're hearing something different.
Right.
So you probably have got a valid debate as to whether or not he deserves a co-writing credit, but I don't imagine that's a debate that Paul would like to have.
Well, you talk about how, you know, John and Paul, they would, since they couldn't read or write music, they would go in and talk to George Martin about how they would want it to sound. So I guess if Paul is, in a way, is telling him, you know, how he wants it to sound, or, you know, instruments they would like in there, I guess in a way you could say that. And then, it is Paul's, you know, baby with, you know, just the assistance of George Martin. You know, he talks about what, you know, with like Penny Lane, you know, tell, you know, hey, have you heard this, like this Bach trumpet, you know, let's add it to, you know, to the song, which is, you know, a nice.
I don't know how to play it, but can you please get it on our next single, please?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, no, he was a very honest man.
Yeah.
George Martin, he was a very honest man because a lot of producers of his, in the early 60s would have just automatically added their credits, their names to the songwriting credits.
Right.
So this, the fact that he didn't shows that he believed in the work. I mean, he could have made a tiny bit of sum of money.
Right.
He'd his name to songwriting credits.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And he had a pretty difficult job as well. I mean, coming off the back of a bunch of hit films with John Barry scores.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you read some of the reviews, they say things like, you know, trying their best to emulate John Barry. But the Martin score for the films is brilliant, and it all started with the song.
Yeah. How did they get John Barry out of it? John Barry brought romanticism, otherworldliness. George Martin goes for like funk, disco, hard hitting. I mean, he preempted the way that the 70s Bond soundtracks were going to. By the time we get to Spy Who Loved Me with Marvin Hamlisch, I hope I'm saying his name right, we're going proper disco with, you know, basically like Bee Gees style guitars and funk bass. And rewatch the opening to Spy Who Loved Me again. It's out and out disco, Saturday Night Fever style.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Carly Simon.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good film.
Yeah. Cool. All right, Adrian, let's move on to get a little update on the McCartney legacy, please. As you said, it's the release date's going to be in October. Where are we in the process at the moment?
Well, we were looking over some proofs for the front cover the other day. So we're hoping, as Owen says, it's we're in the same kind of position in the publishing side of things is completely out of our hands. But we were looking over covers, which means that we should be getting close to pre-orders soon. We were told that pre-orders would start in March. So hopefully we'll be able to post a link for pre-orders sometime in the next month or so. So that would be good. Excellent. I mean, we delivered the manuscript last October, but obviously with everything that's happened with the pandemic, things were slightly delayed, and also a bunch of musicians and actors who had nothing else to do, they all wrote books. So
right,
I hate when they do that.
Yes.
so poor Alan and me, you know. But in a way, the delay has actually helped us because over the last 12 months, since we delivered the manuscript, we found more and more stuff that we've added to the book. So so you guys are actually getting, the benefit of the delay. The book should be coming out October. We were told October the 15th, but don't hold me to that.
Right.
It'll certainly be worth the wait. I mean, Mark Lewison went on the Nothing Is Real podcast and said it would be that he thinks it'll be the definitive book on Paul McCartney.
Oh, absolutely. I 100% believe that.
It will be.
You know, yeah. Well, some of the information that you've given me, I mean, some of the information that, you know, Cozen has talked about, I don't see why this isn't this is what all McCartney fans should want. This is
your guys' volume 2 will come out sooner before Lewison's volume 2. I bet you that.
Yeah, you're probably right, actually. Right.
So speaking of volume 2, though, so you guys are contracted for 2 volumes at the moment, though, right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, no publisher is going to give you a 5-book deal.
Well,
maybe unless you're J.K. Rowling or something. Right. You know? But they're not going to give me and Alan a 5-book deal. We were very lucky to get a 2-book deal.
Right.
So this first volume will come out this year. We deliver the second manuscript around this time next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they said 2024. For publication, but that might change. I don't hold me to any of these dates.
But
we're working on the second book as we speak. So it's been strange revisiting the early 70s because my head is completely in punk and new wave right now.
Yeah, exactly. I get it.
Yeah, and Paul's answer to punk and new wave, which was a Scottish ballad.
Only on the A side.
On the A side. Okay, yeah. In fact, yeah, because of course, in America, you know, the B-side got more plays than the A-side, yes, didn't it?
That's true. Right. It
high,
true.
Didn't go higher in the charts as well.
Yes, yeah. It did. Yeah. It sure did. So does Volume 1 end at December 73, or do you end before? Can you give us any insights on that?
Yeah, the first book has a kind of definitive cutoff, which is the end of 73.
Okay.
And we kind of throw forward a little bit, because what we really wanted to do was end the first book with Band on the Run at number one. But okay, as we all know, that didn't happen for a while.
So, right.
And in the meantime, Paul's rebuilding Wings. So yeah. we end the first book with a kind of Paul coming full circle, really. He's gone from being dethroned when the Beatles disbanded to, you know, clawing his way back to the top with Band on the Run and creating this incredible album out of adversity. Mm-hmm. That's the end. That's the end of the first volume. And then we pick up the second volume in 74 with, recording the McGear album, rebuilding Wings, going to Nashville, which is incredible. I mean, we could write a book about Nashville.
We've had Dan Ely on, and he's told us, you know, his experience with that whole, bit. So,
That story is just something else. And then we go through, see the end of, well, in fact, I'm not going to give away the end of the second book.
Right,
yeah,
please
it's,
don't.
It's, yeah. It, yeah. It, we'll end probably, sometime in 1980.
Okay, yeah. Great. All right. So now it's up to us. Once these books come out, let's support Owen. Let's support Adrian and Alan Kozin, so we can continue to get books from these fellas. And hopefully, if these first two volumes do well for Adrian and Alan, maybe we can also get a volume three or a volume four. So let's help support these guys, because again, just from some of the text that Adrian has sent me and some of the time that we spent with Kozin, with him talking about the books, I don't doubt that this is going to be just a wonderful series. So please get out there and purchase these books. Adrian, tell us some contact information. How can people get a hold of you or email you if they want to get a hold of you, or do you want to stay?
We've got, you can find information about the series on our website, which is just www.mccartneylegacy.com. And you'll find our contact information on there. We do get emails and information through from people from all over the world, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. You open your inbox on a Monday morning and you've got photographs of Paul on a beach in Spain in 1972 or something, and this is all stuff that's going into the book. So it's getting the word out about this series is so important. We're still debating, and the book's going to print soon, whether or not Wings played a gig in Oxford on the university tour, which is just this big topic of debate now. I've looked through every archive in England and spoken to the archivists at the university in Oxford, and I can't find any evidence that Wings played a concert there. So either that's just some information that's crept in somewhere along the line and has made it onto Paul's website and all over the internet. Everyone thinks that there was this concert in Oxford. So if there's anybody listening to this podcast who was at the Oxford gig in February 1972, get in touch with us, because we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
excellent. Owen.
I have an email. It's my name, owenling@gmail.com. I'm also on Twitter, and you can tweet at me there. Send your little tweets at me, preferably nice ones.
Very good. Very good.
I would love to. I'm making it my mission statement to try and interview Paul McCartney someday. I'll do whatever I can.
Well, you and everybody else. that's great. Andy, anything you want to add before we sign off, my friend?
No, I'm just looking forward to these books, man. I can't wait to get my hands on, of course, the Legacy book and Owen's book on Harrison. And I've always been an avid fan of that period, and I look forward to diving into that 70s period that Owen is going to be giving us. So looking forward to both of these books, gentlemen. Thank you.
Yeah. You guys are both going to see Paul live, are you? In the States.
He will. He's not coming in my area. He's not coming to my area. So, and I'm not one of those guys that'll travel to different cities to, you know, to see.
I was just going to ask you guys, is there anything you'd like Paul to introduce to his set? Because every time I've seen him play, I mean, that's a debate for the ages, isn't it? I've seen Paul about 10 times live, and and he does introduce like different songs when he's doing different shows, doesn't he? I mean, is there anything you'd like to hear him play? Maybe from his last album, or further back.
We did a little dream set list 2 weeks ago. And then we talked about it when we went live a couple days ago, where we, you know, what is he going to do for McCartney 3? Well, we definitely think he's going to do Find My Way. We definitely think he's going to do Sliding. I think he's going to do Women and Wives, just for the fact that he's got that 12-inch single coming out in the UK for Record Store Day. Andy, you got a couple ideas of what you would like to see him do live from the new album, right? You said Seize the Day, was it, maybe?
I'd love to see Seize the Day get done. It's my favorite track from the album, as long as it's a healthy smattering of new stuff, and you get the classic Wings material in there. If you keep Junior's Farm and Listen to What the Man Said, which has been in the rotation the last couple of years, I'd be happy after not seeing him, and he's been off the road for such a while. So, as long as there's a healthy amount of Wings in that set list, I'd be okay with it.
Yeah. Let's get many people for the Wings fans, right?
Going back to a show I did with the two of you, I would love if he played Footprints for the first time.
Absolutely.
I can just imagine. All he needs is just on his guitar. Beautiful.
Exactly. It's endless, you know. Lavatory Lil from McCartney 3, I think, would be a great addition too. I mean, just a good rocker, you know. But if he's, you know, kind of peppers us with songs that he doesn't do every tour, like Band on the Run, Hey Jude, Let It Be, whatever. I mean, it's fine. But get rid of Here Today and get rid of Something now. Let's move on from that and do something different, you know.
As someone who's never seen Paul live, I'll just go to see him and be happy with what I've got if he comes to Dublin.
You know, I hear you. As the story likes to tell, well, there's always going to be someone seeing me for the first time, and you know, and they're going to want to hear those songs, you know. So, absolutely. There's plenty of tracks I would love to see him do live. You know. But you can everybody, you can reach us at on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Two Legs Podcast. Please check out our YouTube channel, Two Legs, a Paul McCartney Podcast, where we're getting close to 1,000 subscribers. And as you all know, we're going to do a special contest once we hit that 1,000 subscriber goal. And we've got, for a giveaway, we've got the red vinyl for the McCartney record, which came out in 2017. And we've got the recently released Wings Wildlife Half-Speed Master that we'll be giving away as well. So we've got these two LPs that we'll be giving away once we hit that 1,000 subscriber goal. Andy, my friend, is good hanging out with you. Adrian, Owen, always a pleasure. Adrian, you're welcome back anytime. Owen, same with you. It's always a pleasure. I look forward to chatting with you. Alan, are you going to plan any plans to come to the States once the book is out, or...
Before the pandemic, there was some talk we were going to do a book launch in New York. Whether that happens now, I don't know. Hopefully it'd be great to get stateside again. I had such a blast last time I was in New York. Always a blast.
Great. If anybody out there has an idea for a show that they would like to see us do, email us at twolegspodcast@gmail.com. We'll take a look at them, and we will definitely consider those. Again, for Owen, Adrian, Andy, this is Tom, as always, telling everybody, have a great day and a beautiful night. Take care, everyone.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan C.